Hi there, and welcome back to the Energy Sector Heroes podcast. My name is Michelle Fraser, and every week I will speak with incredible people who share their lessons, experiences, and stories from their time spent in the energy sector. Hi there, and welcome back again to this week's episode. If you're new to the show, then please take a second to subscribe and even consider sharing the show with just one other person. This week, I am joined by Brian Mercer. Brian is the director of Orbank Consultancy Services Limited. Brian, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Many thanks, Michelle. Pleasure to be here. I mean, yes, I've been the director of Orbank Consultancy Services Limited actually since 2018. Although I've done a variety of things actually in the oil industry actually over the past, well, nearly 20 years now. Prior to that, I was an engineer officer in the Royal Air Force, and my final tour in the Royal Air Force was as the chief engineer at RAF Lossiemouth.
Okay, that's interesting, because I've not had anybody that's come from the forces, I think, maybe on my podcast. Did you find it easy to transfer your skills from the Air Force over to, or the forces over to, the oil and gas industry? Because there's a lot of people that want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely true. I think the beauty is actually having, I think the key thing is actually having the confidence that your skills are a match actually for where you're going to. And confidence is something that I don't generally lack in. And importantly, I think it's recognizing that, let's say, if we're going from one technical environment to another technical environment, as I have always said many times, the laws of physics and maths actually don't change actually by virtue of the industry that you're in. You always encounter that element of, well, you've never grown up in the oil and gas industry, so what do you know about oil and gas? And all I'll say is that probably for the first year, 2 years max, you get that label of, oh, you're the ex-Air Force guy. And once you've actually got over that, and you've actually established your credibility, then that actually becomes a thing of the past. And people forget that very quickly. Oh, you're the guy that actually was with KBR or PSN or Wood or whatever. So that sort of thing is it picks itself up very quickly.
Okay. So you say that you don't lack in confidence. How do you get confidence for all our younger listeners?
I think it's recognizing that you've actually got something that's worth having, that you've got skills, capabilities, experience that is there actually that others would actually like to have part of or be part of. So I think more than anything else, there's an element of, I think you have some people that are actually sort of naturally have confidence or have more confidence than others, but it's as you gain experience actually through working through education, through working, then that confidence in your own ability actually starts to build. And that's something that you can then sort of work towards actually in the future. The other thing is, if I look at my previous experience, given that I was an engineering officer, then things like engineering and management training and development is actually consistent all the way throughout my military life, all the way up from being a junior officer to a senior officer. And that's something that becomes easily transferable as well. So again, it just builds that element of belief in yourself, which naturally comes out as confidence.
Okay. Interesting. So how did you get your start in the oil and gas industry, in the energy?
It's a good question. I was actually looking for a different challenge at the time. I mean, at the time, there was the dangle of further promotion in the Air Force, but I would have been down sort of London, or let's say the M4 corridor between London and Ensley, which is Bristol Bath, in a senior officer appointment that didn't excite me, if I'm honest. And I was actually looking for different opportunities. And obviously, my background being aerospace and being a chartered aeronautical engineer, then that would have been the easy leap to somewhere like British Aerospace or so on. But sometimes I think you need a bit of a different challenge, and without boring you too much or boring the listeners too much, then fundamentally I got wind of the oil and gas industry actually looking for, let's say, people with my sort of skills and background, and I thought, that sounds interesting, I'll make a phone call. And that was KBR Production Services at that time. So I phoned them up And I spoke to, I think it was John Kearney, if I remember correctly, who said, yes, John Kearney and Peter Brown, if I remember correctly, said, yes, you are the type of person that we're actually looking for. Would you like to come down for a chat? And that's how it went from there. And what I particularly liked about that is that in the background, I was having conversations with a couple of aerospace companies who were just taking so long to move anything forward. Whereas when I spoke with KBR Production Services, things went very, very quickly. It went from a quick chat to, we'd actually like to get you back for a formal interview so we can make you a formal job offer. And I liked that dynamism that was things happening very, very quickly. The northeast of Scotland, I'm not originally from the northeast. I'm originally a Fifer, but still up in Scotland was a nice opportunity. And I wanted to give some stability to the family as well, because I'd moved the family around quite a lot at that point. The kids were still young and we wanted to give them stability in school. So there are a whole host of factors went into it. But in terms of moving to the oil industry, very much the dynamism that I experienced of that first initial step was actually very prominent in my thinking.
Okay. Do you think that the oil industry is still quite a fast-paced moving industry? Do you think it's slowed down a bit?
At times. I think for the right things it does. I think at times it can be quite turgid when it moves. I think that there's certainly more that can be done to sort of say increase the pace and get back to that. But I do accept that there's some challenging environments at the moment, and let's say the oil industry is not necessarily a sort of flavour of the month actually in some quarters, particularly in some political quarters.
I know. I think sometimes that we are the bad people, the oil and gas. But I think with the energy transition, I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I think a lot of people think it will, but I don't think it will.
No, I agree with you completely. And I think it's incredibly naive of some of the population to believe that you can shut oil off now or even sometime in the near future and think it's going to whirlwind over. And importantly, if we actually look at it from energy security, actually all the way through to economics, actually for the country, whether you're talking Scotland specifically or the UK a bit more broadly, the reality is that it is absolutely necessary actually for a number of years to come yet. And importantly, there's an element of transition that covers everything from the finances to go to sort of, let's say, alternative sources, renewables in particular, but also the employment market. You can't just shut down an industry and expect employment to be there for the personnel that will inevitably actually find themselves out of work.
Okay. But then with less and less engineers coming into the oil industry, then there is going to be that skills gap as well.
I think there's a bit of a skills gap, but in saying that, I'm in touch with a number of personnel actually across a variety of companies. And what not seeing at the moment, from my experience in the industry, is we're not seeing a big shortage in there. We're seeing some personnel actually moving away as things draw back a bit. I mean, obviously, the North Sea Basin is very much in decline. So the requirements are reducing. And we're not getting to the point where there's massive gaps. There are some challenges for sure. But also there's an element of a lot of companies, such as the big engineering companies in particular, actually are diversifying. So personnel are moving into the renewable sectors using the skills that they've obtained in the oil and gas sector.
Okay, because there is a lot of companies still moving into the renewables, because I know that a lot of the big oil companies are doing that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's still going to take time to progress, I would think so.
Of course. I mean, and this is it. It's going to take time to progress, and there's going to be that transition that's necessary to facilitate that happening, which means moving individuals with skills that have been developed in oil and gas through to renewables, and then for the longer term future, as you bring in the young graduates as well as apprentices, etc., actually sort of through the route directly into renewables. So we'll see that transition over a period of time, and then at the older end of the scale, those that have actually grown up and had full careers in the oil and gas industry will be looking to retire at some point.
I think so too. But do you think that a lot of skills are going to be transferable from the oil and gas over to the renewables?
Yeah, I think there's a significant proportion. I mean, particularly those that let's say are electrically biased in particular, and that's everything from systems engineers through electrical engineers. There's certainly going to be the mechanical aspects, less so actually with the likes of the chemical engineers, you know, the process engineers. But there's actually going to be those skills that have actually been developed over the years that are directly transferable. And no one's immune to learning. So there's certainly going to be opportunities for others to, let's say, broaden their skills base to actually allow that transition to take place. Okay. I think the key point is actually making sure that the investment is there to allow individuals to do that.
And do you think the investment is there for individuals to do that?
I think at the moment, I think that the words are actually there. I think the actual investment, I think, is less so. I think there's a bit of a view that it will come organically, and it won't. There's going to be a requirement, actually, from my view, some consistent investment to go in to actually allow individuals to make that. I nearly said leap, and it's not a leap, it's a transition.
Okay. So do you think without anybody investing in that area, that it will become quite significantly harder?
I think that individuals will always look to invest in themselves at times as well. So I think there's a multi-phased approach to it. So investment is absolutely necessary. Investment and commitment from companies actually to transition from oil and gas to renewables is going to be, I think, a real teller. And I think we're already seeing the early signs of that, where major oil companies have already made that commitment that they are actually going to transition. I think that's very important. And all is now is a case of actually following through. And although the renewables have been around for a while now, it's still relatively early days in that transition process. All we're seeing at present, I think, is actually we're seeing a lot of noise in the media that's actually trying to push this faster than is actually sort of, let's say, realistically achievable. And because of that, there's maybe a little bit of a perception that we've got to rush this. And I don't think we do need to rush this. We just need to make sure that we've got consistent plans in place and actually transition effectively.
Okay. Quite interesting. Because I know that I had another young lady on my podcast quite a few months ago, and she actually took voluntary redundancy to go back to the university to study renewables and sustainability.
Yeah, and I think that's what I was talking about in terms of the personal investment. Somebody's actually recognised that they actually want to make a change. They're not prepared to actually hang around until somebody actually, let's say, a company invests in them to do that. So they've taken the bull by the horns and moved themselves into that position to give themselves the best launch platform for their successful career. But at the same time, I think there's an element that says that the big companies have actually got to take a look at it and say, well, we need to do a bit of internal investment on the people that we've already got to take them from the skill set that they currently have to the delta that they need for the new skills package required for the renewables industry, and put some investment into it. Now, that can be through part-time learning. It can be through, let's say, you take a sabbatical, actually, for a couple of years, we'll pay you to go through university to top up or a year for a master's degree or something like that. But that's the type of thing it'll become a blended package where individuals will take some aspects in their own control, and others will get, I'm absolutely sure, support from their existing employing companies, to actually develop their skills to allow their company to progress actually to the next phase of that transition.
Okay. So do you feel that, because you're on your retirement route, do you feel that there is going to be a skills gap with a lot of people retiring and coming out of the oil?
I think that I think there's going to be an element of that. I think what you're going to have, skills gap, skills and experience. Let's break it down into the two. I think what you'll find is that the more experienced element of the oil and gas industry are moving towards retirement, and they're not looking really to transition into a new arena, if you like. So they're going to retire. You're going to get the youngsters coming through who will actually have, let's say, the necessary skills without the experience and without necessarily the role models at, let's say, an older level, to actually bring them forward into that new industry. So I think what we'll find is during that transition, it's just going to be that little bit of lack of experience, which will, let's say, throw up the odd little hiccup every now and again, but nothing that I believe is insurmountable.
Okay, interesting. So do you think it's quite important to have mentors then? During your career?
Yeah, I think mentors are extremely useful. And I think about some of the I mean, obviously I joined the oil industry later. I mean, I was 42, I think, when I joined the oil industry. And so from my perspective, mentoring, no, I wasn't looking for that. But some of the younger guys and girls actually sort of coming in, young men and women coming in, should expect to get some mentoring. And I think it's something that the employment companies in particular, employing companies in particular, should be looking to say, how do we actually help these individuals actually learn and put in some better mentoring programs? I don't think that's actually been done particularly well, actually, over the last couple of decades, if I'm honest.
I was going to wait to say that, because there isn't a lot of mentors in the oil and gas space. You usually have to try and fend for yourself and figure it out for yourself. It can be quite hard for a newly qualified person if they're not getting any guidance.
I agree. I think that you get two types of individuals. You get those that actually sort of love to be thrown in the deep end, and I throw myself into that category and see how well I can swim. And eventually I'll get to the surface and crack on. And you get others who will really struggle with that approach. And I think that there's a balance to be had. There's those that you can recognize very quickly that have actually got, let's say, the skills, the effective intelligence to actually sort of get themselves actually moving down there, and they'll ask all the right questions and seek all the right answers out actually by putting that effort, and I suppose really putting the effort into to actually root out answers and solutions. And there are those that, quite frankly, actually could do with that help in hand. But actually having a mentoring scheme in place so that and it can be nothing more than having someone that you can go to that's actually been dedicated, that you've got somebody that you can have the off-the-record conversations with to say, let me ask all the stupid questions that someone then can answer me back. And it's not going to have any impact where somebody in a meeting says, well, that's a stupid question. I would personally hope nobody ever say that, but we've all been in meetings where that has been said in the past. Not a clever response, but there we go. But I mean, it's just having that someone that you can go to actually ask the questions. It's, let's say, non-attributable. It's not going to have any impact at all in the way that you actually perceive actually around about the business. And it just helps you in your development, and importantly, builds your confidence in the process.
Yeah, I know. But I've never really had, I've had a lot of things said to me, but I've never really had that said to me about a question is silly, because I don't think any question is silly, especially with a younger graduate person.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, my viewpoint is that there is one silly question, and that's the one that gets formed in your head that actually never makes it to your lips. Because if you never ask the question, you never get an answer. In my own experience, I often think that somebody somewhere will pipe up in a meeting that will be the silly question, you know, inverted commas, as I say, that everyone else in that meeting goes, God, I'm glad he or she asked that, because I was thinking it, but I didn't want to ask it. And it's important that we actually do pipe up with questions. So, as I said, the only silly question is the one that's formed in your head that never make it to your mouth.
But it can be quite challenging for meetings, actually. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of them are quite aggressive.
Yeah. I have been in a meeting. I mean, I remember in early time in the oil industry, and I won't mention which oil company it was, but I was actually working with a particular oil company, and we're in a meeting, and somebody did shoot an individual down, a relatively young individual down in flames, for a question that was actually asked in the middle of the meeting. And I have to say that I had a little off-the-record conversation with that individual, not the individual asked the question, but the guy that actually shot the young individual down in flames outside the meeting, and said, really shouldn't do that, not a clever idea, because at the end of the day, you want people to be asking questions, even whether you think it's an obvious question that they should have known the answer to. The bottom line is, they didn't ask it if they already knew the answer.
Yeah, I think I remember being in a meeting like that when I was very young, a very young engineer, and I remember that one of the senior project I think senior project managers was having their big speech about the project, and then he was saying something about if something happened, and then if you challenged him, he would just say, "Well, I don't know what's going to happen." Whereas sometimes the big speeches usually come from a lot of air not behind them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. What you're saying is that sometimes the big speeches actually come as a bit of almost bluster and bravado about it, rather than actually having the real facts behind it to do that. And there's a place for a bit of that in terms of actually sort of scene setting and putting things forward. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty bits of a project or a program, the bottom line is you need facts to be able to back up actually what you're saying. And that's really important, because ultimately there's going to be an awful lot of clever people in your audience who will likely actually ask a question. And if you don't know the answer, the last thing you should be doing is shooting them down in flames. If nothing else, what you should do is saying, "Sorry, I don't have the answer to that at the moment, but I'll get it."
Yeah, I know. I do. And I think there's no shame in admitting that either, because mm-hmm. not everybody knows everything. Not even the most experienced person that could have 30 plus years in industry. Yeah, they don't know everything. They don't know everything either.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. And that's why, if you're in a senior position, surround yourself with good people. Don't surround yourself with yes men, yes women. Surround yourself with good, talented people, because that way you all grow together. That's why we employ experts.
Yeah, that is. Yes, I do agree with that, actually. But it's hard to get the experts, I think, now, mm-hmm. especially with a lot of them retiring.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true, but I mean, always remember, nobody's indispensable. And, let's say 20 years ago, the young men and women that actually came into the industry were very green around the gills. They are the experts now. They've actually grown their capabilities actually over that period of time. They've developed their expertise, and they should recognize that. And those in more senior positions should also be recognizing that and making sure that they're actually, let's say, the right piece of the jigsaw actually going into place.
Okay, interesting. I'm going to ask you, what has been the most challenging thing in your career?
Oh, gosh. The most challenging thing in my career? Difficult to say. I mean, if I look back at it, it was actually, one of the things I would say is just making sure that when I first came into the industry, was actually shaking off the you're the guy from the Air Force, but that doesn't take that long. I mean, when all said and done, it a year, 2 years, something like that, then people forget that you're the ex Air Force guy. And then really, it's actually just building your next steps. I mean, bear in mind, I came from the military, where you do things a certain way, but I think importantly, there's huge amount of skills transfer available, everything actually from the technical aspects, but particularly through leadership and managerial capabilities that sometimes I think are actually sort of sadly missing actually in aspects of the oil industry. And certainly I do think there's much more that can be done actually by the bigger companies to develop individuals' managerial and leadership capabilities. So getting, trying to get individuals in and move them forward that way, I think is always a challenge. But in my own challenges, yeah, probably that first bit of actually getting your credibility established in a new industry after spending a long time in something else.
So what do you think that the organizations can do to improve the situation then?
Well, with leadership and putting proper leadership development programs, because I think at the moment, I think there's a few things. I think, first of all, I think in certain positions, particularly in sort of technical or technician type positions, whether it be onshore or offshore, often it becomes he's the most senior technician because he's got the longest time actually in that type of position. Therefore, when the position for the supervisor comes up or whatever, then they're the next obvious choice, when the reality is they may not be, because they don't show the necessary, let's say, leadership and managerial potential to actually move into that position. And before I come back, and I will come back to that in a second, and it's the same onshore, is that when individuals are actually looking to take their next steps, looking to get into a more senior position, to take a, let's say, an engineering lead position or an engineering manager position or a commercial manager position or whatever. It's they're applying for it themselves. They think they've actually got the skills there because they've built up all the, let's say, the base level skills that are necessary. But it's a different ball game when they move in. And now they find themselves actually in charge of a team, an organization. And that's people. And people respond differently to what you do on a computer. And it's important to get the, let's say, the skills development on how to lead effectively, how to manage effectively, how do you actually sort of deal with some of the challenges that people will inevitably actually sort of put in front of you. And I don't think there's enough investment in actually putting those programs in place or those training packages in place to allow people to actually get that skills development. And that's exactly the same onshore as it is offshore. And when we're looking at offshore technical positions, then from my perspective, there's got to be an element of, let's say, choosing the right person. And I do recall an example from some years ago of being involved in that and stepping in and saying, no, I think we need to select a different person than has been identified at the moment, because every time I've been offshore, it's always been this other individual that has been the one that's actually shown the potential to want to lead, has actually got a real desire to lead. It's always the one that's actually looking for to go the extra mile, who's actually looking at the wider picture to see what else could actually happen here, rather than the guy that's actually the more senior or, let's say, the older technical specialist. And that works better. So I think there's more needs to be done in terms of identifying and selecting potential and then giving the skills development to put the individuals actually in the right place. And I think that would actually sort of serve us all better, both on and offshore.
I totally agree. But I don't think there is leadership plans in a lot of the big oil companies.
No, I think that's true. I think it's the same in the big engineering companies too. I think there's some, and we always tend to have plans in place of, let's say, there's elements of personal development plans, but it never really actually gets into what I'd term sort of formal, proper identified leadership development and training. There are some pockets of it, for sure, but I don't think it's consistent enough across the industry.
I don't think so either. I remember when I was quite a young engineer, a lot of the big engineering and oil companies, they used to do graduate training programs. I think they've stopped that now, have they?
I think they still do some of it, but whether it's at the same level or not as it was, let's say, 20 years ago, I don't know. I've not been into that in detail, actually, for some time.
Maybe they should bring them back. Maybe.
For sure.
I think so. So have you had any career disasters?
Well, I think everybody's had the odd career disaster. I say career disasters. I mean, there's things that you look back and say, I could have done that differently, or I should have made that move instead. I would say there's nothing that leaps to mind. Sort of joining a particular organization or taking a particular job. Yeah, you look back and go, maybe there were other opportunities I could have done instead. And I can think of, if I go back about sort of 10, 12 years of an opportunity to perhaps go overseas that maybe I could have or should have taken when it was there. Hindsight is easy to look back on, but I didn't for whatever reason at the time. If it was about 12 years ago, if I remember rightly, then it was probably because of kids' schooling that I didn't take something like that.
Okay. I think stability is quite important, actually, in a family life as well, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was a factor on why I decided to leave the Royal Air Force and actually sort of take on a different challenge. It was part of it was giving my kids sort of, you know, more stable schooling. I mean, my kids are now 27 and 25. My son's a 27-year-old. He's an army officer now. So he's in the Royal Electrical Mechanical Engineers. And my daughter, she's actually down in Glasgow. She's done a bachelor's degree, a master's degree in Glasgow. And was working for a Glasgow-based fashion company that she's just been made redundant from because they're doing a restructure to actually sort of co-locate everything down in the south of England. So she finds herself actually now looking for her next steps actually through that.
Yeah, but sometimes when that happens, something even better is in the background.
That's what I tell her, Michelle. That's exactly what I'm telling her, that you'll look back in a year's time when you say, do you know what, this was actually a good thing to happen.
Yeah, I think so too. I do think so too. So do you think it's important for maybe the younger engineers to maybe go abroad or at least go offshore?
I don't think they necessarily have to go offshore. I think they've got to be prepared to go offshore to actually see what their engineering, let's say, in the office actually does from, let's say, a project and construction perspective. For sure, they've got to see that through. Going overseas, I think, always gives an extra dimension to it. So I would always encourage somebody, if you get the opportunity to go overseas, do it, particularly early on in your career, before, let's say, families actually come into it. Go out there and actually sort of find out what it's like, experience different cultures, bring in different ways of thinking. I think that's always really important, because we're not homogeneous in the way we think. Not even in the UK are we homogeneous in the way we think, let alone when we start getting into multinational environments. And it's always good to actually sort of try and get a perspective of how somebody else thinks and how different systems are in place in different countries. And all of that can actually sort of help expand your own knowledge, but can always bring something back when you come back to the UK.
Yeah, I think so. I think so with myself traveling. I think I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
That I could, benefit any company, I would think so.
I mean, in my own professional life, actually, if we cover my whole professional life, I've spent time, I mean, obviously I've spent time in England, Scotland, actually, in the UK, but I've also spent time in the US, I've spent time in the Middle East, and I've spent time in Europe as well. So, you know, that all these things actually sort of help expand your understanding, and it's good just to enhance the skill set.
So where was your favourite place that you've worked on then?
Oh, gosh, now you're asking. Favourite place? Aberdeen couldn't have been bad, because I actually spent a long time in Aberdeen. I spent about 17 years in Aberdeen, 17, 18 years in Aberdeen. So, like I said, everything has peaks and troughs, but I spent a long time working in Aberdeen and enjoyed working in Aberdeen and enjoyed working with a lot of people I've worked with. But if we actually look at it, I mean, I spent 2.5 years in the United States, actually, back in the mid-90s when I was in the Air Force. And again, I worked with some fantastic people there, but that was in the aviation sector. So I enjoyed that. I spent 3.5 years in Germany in the 1980s, and I thoroughly enjoyed that too, because it also allowed me to go and learn another language too. So there's all sorts of things I can take from it. I mean, I've never had a bad place to work.
No, me neither.
Favourites, difficult to say, to be honest. I think you can take pluses and minuses from everything. And I'm one of these individuals that believes that it's not about the location. It's not about the company. It's not even about the job in many respects. It's about your attitude that you actually take into it. And I think there's a lot of people out there that could benefit from that. Actually, understanding it's about what you make of it, not what's actually given to you. Is what you actually apply, how well you apply yourself into it tends to generate the rewards that come back from it.
I think so, because I think, but it can be challenging as well when you're mm-hmm. going off to a new job and in a new country. It's quite a lot of change for maybe even anybody to comprehend.
Yeah. I mean, I spent 2.5 years in Saudi was December 1999 to August 2002. So it was in my previous life. And yeah, there were some aspects that were very rewarding. There were some aspects that were extraordinarily frustrating living in Riyadh. And as my wife would tell you, she said, I'm glad we did it, but don't ever ask me to do that again.
I've never been to Saudi. That's one place I haven't been.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not meant to be so bad.
Sorry?
It's not meant to be so bad.
Not now. I mean, because at the time when we were in Saudi, I mean, certainly Tracy wasn't allowed to drive or anything like that. And there was all sorts of other restrictions that were in place. And you work around them. But no, it's not a place that I would rush back to.
But even that must be challenging, though. Because that's just a really small, significant change.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, there were all sorts of things. And working working within the sort of the Saudi culture, getting to understand that they've actually got a different approach to things that I have, and then actually trying to work ways around about it. And you spend a lot of time actually sort of second guessing actually how they might respond, and then importantly, as you thought, second guessing how should I approach this to actually so I can get to the end state that I want to get to. So you spend a lot of time actually, let's say, juggling.
Do you think so? Because I've never, well, I've worked in the Middle East once and I quite enjoyed it.
It depends where you are in the Middle East, because like I said, the different nationalities are culturally very different depending on where you go.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with Saudis. I've worked with Bahrainis. I've worked with Omanis. Take my word for it. They can be significantly different in the approach they take.
Okay.
And the attitude. Yeah.
So what is the most challenging thing about working in the Middle East?
I think sort of fitting in and making things happen, actually, against a culture that can be notoriously slow at making things happen.
You think so? Because I've travelled quite a few places all over the world, and I think the way everybody engineers is significantly different.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think that's very true. And getting, let's say, actions to happen at times can be more challenging in some regions than others.
Yeah, because I've worked in Norway and Scandinavia quite a few times, and they can be quite slow at making things happen as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. But I said the slowest I've had was certainly when I worked in Saudi. It's a long persuasion exercise to try and get individuals to go on the path that is absolutely necessary to make things happen.
Yeah. I kind of do agree with that. And sometimes they don't really like change.
Nope.
As well.
Yep. And don't like change when it's somebody else actually telling them that the change needs to happen and it's not their own.
Even getting away from the Middle East, how do you even bring up change? If you have a really good idea, how would you bring up change to your management?
I've been in the fortunate position where I've been management for a very, very long time. So often it's the other way around. I think we need change. And then it's effectively communicating with the workforce and saying that here's what the situation is. And I think the important thing is actually being open to communication. And I think as much as anything else is being receptive to alternative ideas. I mean, I've been in a position a number of times where I've restructured organizations and so on. And it's not just a case of, right, this is what we're doing, bang, put it in place. I've seen that done. That tends not to work particularly well. And it's important that you start building up so you understand, sort of feed the team what the problem is, give them an understanding of why we're actually looking at alternatives to the status quo, and giving them an opportunity to have a voice so that they can pipe up and have an input to it. So you don't just shut them off and don't give them the opportunity to have that voice, so they're not going to be listened to. And where there's good ideas, snatch them up. You know, take them, use them, build it into the overall plan. If you need to tweak the plan accordingly to do that, but at least actually get them to feel that they've got an important part to play in the future of the company, the organization, whatever.
Okay.
I don't think it happens enough.
You don't think so?
No.
Why is that?
I think sometimes, I think there's probably a variety of reasons. I mean, I can think of a couple of companies recently that have actually gone through a few restructures in the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And I can think of a couple where it's just been, right, that's what we're doing. We're just going to get on with it. And that's just not helpful. Somebody else has got the idea and then just fed it. That's the way we're going to do it. Sometimes you've got to be a bit more hard-nosed about it. And as you say, well, we're a large enough organization. We've consulted with the right people. And then there's maybe an expectation that gets communicated down the chain of command, if you like, for want of a better term. And new ideas have maybe been captured that way. But there's maybe assumptions there that communication has taken place that actually hasn't. But the bottom line is that you've got to adjust it actually in accordance with the size of the organization. But where you can is actually communicate it. Communicate what's happening, communicate why it's happening, and how long it's going to take, what the effect's actually going to be, and whether people are going to be impacted or not.
Because I think when, especially when senior management mention or communicates a restructuring in the company, a lot of people start to panic.
Yeah, I think that's human nature though, Michelle. I think that's absolutely human nature because, you know, anybody who's actually been around an industry for a period of time is actually going to recognize that restructuring generally means that either personnel's jobs are actually going to change, their organization's going to change, or even as the alarm bells ring with many people, restructure means, am I going to have a job at the end of it? And that I think that's a natural reaction to the term restructuring. I think actually sort of given a bit more in the background, given a bit more of the rationale behind it and what the vision is going forward will actually help, let's say, ease that, I suppose, that sledgehammer approach.
Do you think that a lot of companies do that, though?
Not as well as they should.
Okay. So do you have any advice for them to how they can manage it better?
There's always ways. I said communication is really important. I mean, and if anybody out there would actually sort of like to have a chat with me about it because they've actually got some thoughts going through their head, I'd be more than happy to offer some advice and assistance.
Excellent. Excellent answer, actually. Excellent answer. Right. I'm going to ask you, do you have any advice for any young graduates wanting to come into the energy sector?
Do it. My advice is do it. When all said and done, don't be put off by the, if it's oil and gas, I mean, there's still going to be an oil and gas industry around for years to come. And yes, the production is going to tail off, but decommissioning is going to be there. The skills that you will actually pick up in the process will be invaluable throughout your professional life and are easily and readily transferable. I said, I'm actually a chartered aeronautical engineer by background, and I came into the oil and gas industry and made a second successful career in that industry. And I've got no doubt that if I wanted to go through for a much longer term and get a lot less here and even more grey, then the renewables is very much there because the skills are readily transferable. Don't be scared of it. Don't be scared of actually the noise that comes out in the media saying that oil is bad. It is not. It is essential. And it is part of actually having that ethical transition going forward.
Okay. Excellent advice. So I'm going to wrap up things. I always ask this question. If you could turn back time, would you change anything?
No. There's always little tweaks that you can do here and there. But actually, I look at my professional life from university onwards, and I think, yep, I've actually had a really good professional life. Really good.
It really sounds it as well, actually. So I would like to wrap things up now. That's all the questions I have today. I would like to thank Brian for your time. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening and see you next week. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, I'd like to gently encourage you to leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with another person. You can also follow me on LinkedIn or via my website, www.michellefraserconsultancy.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week.